2 years ago, Lehman Brothers, one of Wall Street's most respected and most profitable firms, collapsed. The Bush administration and the Federal Reserve made the decision to let Lehman go down and then watched horrified as the collateral damage spread through the economy. To talk about Lehman Brothers is Peter Chapman. He's an editor at the Financial Times. He's just published a history of Lehman Brothers called The Last of the Imperious Rich. Good morning.
Good morning, Elinda.
Lehman Brothers was a legendary firm. It survived two world wars. It survived the Depression. But it did not survive the financial crisis of 2008. Could you just give us a capsule of what happened that day?
Lehman Brothers had some enormous investments in subprime mortgages, mortgages being given to people who, in the end, couldn't pay them. Therefore, it had huge amounts of debt. And what happened then is the money that Lehman Brothers owed to other banks was called in. And Dick Ford was the CEO, and he was getting calls from other CEOs saying, Dick, you owe us money. Your credit rating's not looking too good. Your stock price is going through the floorboards. Hand over some money. When Lehman Brothers went, it was like pulling the plug out of the sink. All the confidence seemed to be draining out of the Western capitalist system, not just in the United States, but it spread throughout the world. Financial Armageddon was a term that people used, and certainly that was a great fear at the time.
And of course, one of the other things that happened was that the United States government, which had decided not to bail out Lehman Brothers because of the improbably huge amount of money that would have required, then had to spend even more money trying to sort of get the stopper in that drain.
Indeed, and it was a gross indignity politically as well. The administration of George W. Bush had probably been the most ideologically free market administration since the 1920s. Suddenly, it was taking over banks. It was almost as if a communist regime were there, if you like. Marx used to talk about seizing control of banks and things, and suddenly, the most Republican, the most ideologically right-wing government for many a year was having to do that.
Was it the right thing to do at the time? Did it prove to be the right thing to do now, 2 years later?
In my opinion, absolutely not. And if I could cite a bit of history there, President Franklin D. Roosevelt's right-hand man in building the New Deal was Herbert Lehman, partner of Lehman Brothers. And he saw that the failure of banks was the key factor which turned the Great Crash of 29 into the depression of the 1930s. He fought to keep banks open, knowing it would drain confidence out of the system. Ironically, 70 years or so later, it was his own family bank that was involved in this very kind of thing. Certainly, if Herbert Lehman had been around, he'd have saved his bank. He wouldn't have let it off. He'd have rigorously regulated it afterwards. But I think, certainly in my opinion anyway, it was a serious mistake to let Lehman Brothers go.
This week, financial regulators who were meeting in Switzerland agreed to some new rules, increasing the amount of money that banks must keep in reserve to balance against potential losses. If those rules had been in place 2 years ago, would Lehman Brothers have been able to get in so much trouble?
Those rules would have certainly helped. Lehman Brothers, for example, had only $1 in reserve for every $40 it had borrowed. That kind of ratio was completely unsustainable. But there's all the other things that people are worried about as well. What about the trading departments of these banks? Are their activities going to be curbed in any way? What about the bonuses? What about the bankers' salaries and things like that? If the economy grows, then people might forget about that. If we move towards a double-dip recession, then once again the anger will rise.
Peter Chapman, thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Linda.
Peter Chapman's new book is called The Last of the Imperious Rich, A History of Lehman Brothers.
2 years ago this week, the insurance giant AIG was in the middle of one massive cash crunch. Its problems were triggered by some $2.5 trillion in outstanding derivatives contracts. So the federal government stepped in with an enormous and enormously controversial bailout. Today, AIG still owes taxpayers more than $100 billion, but both the company and the government say they're taking steps to cut the ties that bind them to each other. NPR's Jim Zaroli reports.
When the Treasury Department and the Federal Reserve Bank of New York bailed out AIG 2 years ago, they acquired a huge share of the company in return, and U.S. taxpayers now own some 80% of the company. Today, all of the parties involved would like nothing better than to see the relationship end, says Clark Troy, senior analyst at Aite Group.
The belief is, and there's really no reason to doubt this belief, is that the quicker they can move to restore confidence from all major stakeholders, the better it is for everyone.
Today, the Treasury Department is in talks with AIG to look for ways to make the company independent again. But extricating the government from AIG is a complex and delicate task. One problem for the government is that the company still owes the Fed and the Treasury Department some $100 billion. That's come down a lot in recent months, but AIG still depends on the government for financial assistance, and cutting it off too soon would hurt its bond rating. So AIG has been selling off some of its prized assets, like its Asian insurance unit, paying off debt, and trying to get its balance sheet in order. Christopher Whalen is managing partner at Institutional Risk Analytics.
The best way to do that is to run this company, get it in the best shape possible in terms of its operating results, and then see if we can quietly, you know, reduce and ultimately sell off the government stake. That's a happy ending.
But selling the government's stake will be a tricky process. The U.S. owns preferred shares of AIG stock. It plans to convert them into common shares, which means they can be sold on the open market. But the government owns so much of AIG stock that selling too much of it too quickly would cause its share price to plummet. So it has to go slowly and look for the right opportunities, says Whalen.
And they have to wait until the market is got a positive enough view of the company that they can sell stock.
U.S. officials say once they do sell the shares, they believe they can recoup the taxpayers' investment in AIG and even turn a profit. Whalen is skeptical.
Is it possible? Sure. Will they make money in real inflation-adjusted terms? I don't know.
The good news is that aside from the derivatives debacle of 2 years ago, AIG remains a pretty strong and profitable company. It has new management, and it's been slowly unwinding the massive portfolio of bad investments it had and concentrating on what it knows best, the insurance business. Again, Clark Troy.
AIG has a lot of strong brands. There's a lot of good insurance companies and a lot of good insurance competency within AIG.
There is precedent for what the government hopes to do. U.S. officials have been able to pare down the government's ownership stake in some of the banks it bailed out, like Citigroup. But doing so in a way that minimizes the damage for everyone is likely to require patience. And with the bailout so unpopular, the public may not want to wait very long. Jim Zaroli, NPR News, New York.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm David Green. A federal program that's provided thousands of jobs for low-income people is now on the chopping block. And that brought workers, employers, activists, also Philadelphia Mayor Michael Nutter to Washington today with a message for Congress.
The employers love this program. But most importantly, the workers and their families and certainly their children love this program.
At issue is an emergency fund created in last year's stimulus bill, which helped subsidize jobs in nearly 40 states. The measure is set to expire at the end of the month unless the Senate joins the House and votes to continue the program. NPR's Cheryl Corley reports.
There's been lots of controversy over whether the federal stimulus package has really hit the mark, but there have been rave reviews for one program with the hefty title, the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families Emergency Contingency Fund, or more simply, the TANF Emergency Fund. $5 billion in stimulus dollars set aside in part to pay the wages of low-income workers placed as trainees at government agencies, nonprofits, and plenty of small businesses. That's how David Sullivan, who'd been unemployed for 2 years, got his maintenance job at a small Comfort Suites hotel on Chicago's Michigan Avenue.
Things are tough everywhere. Nobody's got any money, so no businesses want to spend too much money. But if they get me in at $10 an hour and see, okay, I'm worth actually hiring and paying a better wage, then that gives me an opportunity.
Comfort Suites General Manager Natalie Furka says in addition to Sullivan, the hotel was able to add three more people to its staff, including a housekeeper and two welcome ambassadors normally employed at more posh hotels.
Being a brand new small business opening in 2009, we have just seen our service levels, our TripAdvisor scores go up. Having these people at our hotel, we would have not found them otherwise. And it's made such an impact to our business.
The hotel is hiring the workers permanently, even promoting one to a supervisor. The Put Illinois to Work project is one of the largest, with the state using TANF money to pay the wages of about 31,000 people, 5,000 of them youth at summer jobs. But Illinois has already sent out pink slips to thousands of workers, announcing the fund's September 30th end. Sheena Howard has worked at Benford Brown & Associates, a small Chicago accounting firm, since May, and had hoped to be there longer.
So now it's going to be, like, extra hard to go out there and look for another job. Because now these days you have to know somebody.
LaDonna Pavetti with the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities says the 37 states that operate subsidized employment programs have helped about 247,000 people survive this rocky economy. And it would be unfortunate if Congress doesn't extend the subsidy.
It would be different if the unemployment rate was sort of coming down at a rapid pace, but it's not.
The House has voted twice to extend the emergency fund, but it fell flat in the Senate. Now the push is on to get senators to support a $2.5 billion one-year extension. The biggest advocates have been states, cities, and businesses, regardless of their political stripes. Sue Tuffin heads the Mesa County Workforce Center in Grand Junction, Colorado, where unemployment has floated around 10% for more than a year and a half.
We're going to be basically terminating about 100 individuals. I can guarantee you that the majority of those folks will be right back in my door and back on public assistance if they have not been hired permanently.
And Linda Martin, the director of family assistance in South Carolina, says that state's welfare caseload dropped 1,000 cases because of the subsidized jobs program.
You know, if you have something to offer besides welfare, people want to take it and they want to go to work.
And Martin says she's hopeful that's a message the Senate will take to heart in the next few weeks. Cheryl Corley, NPR News, Chicago.
A historic name in the cotton business is going away. The S.M. Whitney Company was run by the descendants of Eli Whitney, the inventor of the cotton gin. Their company sold cotton to textile factories for almost 150 years, until now. In Augusta, Georgia, C. Statura reports.
Barry Whitney's wingtips press into the dirt floor of one of his brick warehouses. He checks his clipboard with a flashlight.
And this cotton here is gone, too.
Yep.
That's sold.
Whitney is the president of the S.M. Whitney Company. His great-grandfather opened the business in 1868.
Now, what about this back here, son?
Whitney has just 190 bales of cotton left. At its peak, the company brokered deals for 80,000 bales annually. Whitney says he got a lot of that business by talking with farmers.
And I would go call on a farmer, and they would say, oh, he's down the road in such and such a field. So I would run down there and find the farmer. And one thing the farmer really enjoyed doing was taking a visitor and driving him around to see his cotton, his corn, his soybeans.
Those relationships helped Whitney dominate the Augusta cotton market. For a long time, Whitney sold it to local merchants. In the 1980s, two-thirds of American cotton got spun into T-shirts and jeans in U.S. factories.
We used to spend 12.5 million bales here in America, and now it's down to just a little over 3 million.
Mills have been moving overseas since the 1990s. U.S. cotton is still in demand, but growers have cut back. Economist Gary Adams is with the National Cotton Council. He says around 2005, growers noticed that corn and soy fetched a better price.
And a lot of that was due to the higher oil prices, the increased use of corn for ethanol and renewable fuel. So that push drove up grain prices. And farmers looked at those competing market signals and decided to go more toward corn and soybeans and less toward cotton.
Between 2006 and 2009, U.S. cotton acreage dropped by 40%. That's exactly when Whitney's business dried up.
The old world of cotton is probably dead.
Darren Hudson is the director of the Cotton Economics Research Institute at Texas Tech University. He says SM Whitney's closing is the symbolic end of an era. Today's market is all about export sales, not business relationships.
He still could have made that work. It would have been tougher. And that's why a lot of these merchants and co-ops have, you know, a staff or a salesman, you know, that lives in Beijing, works with the textile mills there.
So out goes SM Whitney Company, like every other cotton dealer and mill in the region. Augusta is dotted with cotton museums and restaurants named the Cotton Patch and the Bull Weevil. But at Mi Rancho Mexican Restaurant, Augusta's past is harder to notice. Angela Gifford sits near a window drinking with some friends. From her seat, she can see SM Whitney's back door.
So where is it? Is that door right there?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. I've lived here most of my life. I didn't even know there was such a thing here.
Most people haven't. SM Whitney will sell its last bale of cotton next week. But to many, cotton's reign in the South is already ancient history. For NPR News, I'm Cece DeChura in Augusta, Georgia.